Thank you. First, I want to thank Jeremy and Joel for creating this event and all of the book events that we do have. And I hope that we'll keep supporting him, buying books from these guys who have not just a bookstore, but a community center for us, which is really important. So thanks. And thank you, Mary, for this lovely space, because it kind of feels like we're gathered in somebody's home instead of a store, which is nice. And, you know, I'd like to start with something very simple, if you're open to it. If you're not, you don't have to participate in anything we do this afternoon, but if you feel like it, we'll just take a moment. And the easiest thing to do is be comfortable wherever you're sitting or standing, and close your eyes, and just sense your body in the chair or sense your body standing. And feel how your body is present in this room. Notice your breathing. It might be slow and deep, it might be fast and shallow. However your breathing is okay. All you have to do is notice it. You know, wherever we go, we bring our thoughts, our plans, our remembering things with us. And sometimes it makes it hard to be right where we are because all those things are running through our heads. So just take a moment to be right here with us, all of us. And anytime you're ready, just open your eyes. Thank you. First, I need to tell you, I'm not a Dharma teacher. I'm not a meditation master. I'm not a spiritual guide. I'm none of these things. I'm just another yogi trying to do her best on the path, and have been very fortunate to know people who are meditation masters and Dharma teachers from whom I've learned a lot. And Maninder is one of them. The reason I wrote this book is because he is a meditation master. He was a meditation master. Sometimes I feel as though he's still with us. He was a Dharma teacher, and he was definitely a spiritual guide because he never considered himself a guru. He called himself a Kalyanamita, which in the Pali language means spiritual friend. And this meant that he had no sense of hierarchy. He was always on the ground right there with you. And I remember one person I interviewed said, you know, he was never into sitting up there and taking the throne. Never sat up there like some kind of stuffed Buddha. He was just a friend with everybody. And I think that was part of his great appeal, that people could talk to him about anything, family problems, anything at all. Something that you wouldn't necessarily do with the head monk of a monastery. He had spent a year as a monk in Burma, but when he decided to return to India, he asked his preceptor, who was Mahasi Sayadaw, to give him permission to disrobe, because he wanted to be accessible to everybody. He didn't want to have the restrictions that a monastic lives under. He didn't want that to impede his being able to communicate with women, with anybody at any level. And in fact, he was really, besides being non-hierarchical, he was non-sexist. He was as equal with his female students as he was with the male students. And he taught, I know in Calcutta, he taught Indian housewives, some of whom had no education whatsoever, and who attained such high levels in the practice that they became teachers themselves. Never discriminated in terms of socioeconomic background or gender or anything like that. And I think, again, he was such a, what is that expression? Kind of like an everyman, but he wasn't. He was, in his own way, he was extraordinary, but he did it in a very ordinary way. And in fact, he never thought of himself as, he never expressed that he was exceptional or extraordinary or certainly not perfect. And writing about him really emphasized that for me, because I learned over and over from the stories that I heard people tell how about his quirks and his idiosyncrasies. And for some people, they got to see a lot more than they really wanted to. You know, they wanted their spiritual teacher to be this guru with this mystique around him, and you know, you never got to see what was behind the screen. But with him, what you saw was what you got, and not everybody wanted to see that. I remember one fellow told me a story. He went to visit him in his room once, and Manindra was sitting there. Does anyone know what a dhoti is? In India, the men take this long piece of white cloth and they wrap it around them and they just kind of hang out in that, right? Ordinarily, he wore white robes, and there are pictures in the book of him in his white robes. And this Westerner who just walked in, and Manindra sitting there in his dhoti, completely unadorned, unassuming, and the guy was a little bit taken aback, and he said, you know, I figure if he could be so accepting and at ease and not trying to present a particular front or anything like that, because I guess I could be okay in my skin too. And that was one of the things that people learned from him, that it was okay to just be who you are. Larry Rosenberg is a Dharma teacher at the Cambridge Insight Meditation Center in Cambridge, Massachusetts. And he spent many years, he told me, chanting in Korean, chanting in Japanese, wearing different kinds of robes, eating different kinds of meals in a particular way. And all of that was good and all of that was wonderful. And then he met Manindra and he realized, you know, I don't have to take on the cultural accoutrement of another tradition or country. I can just be myself. He said, I realized it's okay for me to just be a Jewish American guy. Yeah. It was that a lot of people wound up feeling such a sense of ease and comfort being themselves instead of trying to be this spiritual person. Because he was so transparent, really transparent. There's as I said, for some people it was a little bit challenging that he wasn't this perfect saint. He was just a fallible human being. And, you know, sometimes people wanted more than that. But he was never ashamed to show who he was and how he was. And there's a saying in Burma, even when the bottle is empty, there is still a smell. And what they mean by that is, even when you are empty of greed, hatred, and delusion, the three poisons as they're known in Buddhism, there's still a personality. No matter how realized you are, no matter how enlightened you are, there's still a personality. There are things that you're born with that don't ever go away. And to try to get away from that and try to project something else, it's not necessary. So a lot of people sighed with relief being around him. There are so many stories in the book. And Maybe I should tell you a little bit about the book, because I have a lot of stories to tell. I organized the book according to 16 qualities, and each chapter illustrates one of these qualities through how Manindra embodied the quality, how he taught it, what people remembered about how they learned about that quality just by being in his presence. So he was somebody who walked his talk. He wasn't somebody who just gave Dharma talks and then went and did something else. And that was something that a lot of Westerners in particular appreciated, because I don't know where all of you were in the 60s and the 70s, but some people were really dissatisfied with the religious tradition they were brought up in. They were really dissatisfied with government that kept lying to them about Vietnam, and various other authorities that were not embodying integrity and truthfulness, I'll put it that way. So many people went off seeking. Some of them wound up in Asia. They wound up at Zen monasteries in Japan and Korea. Some people wound up in India and Thailand. And they found teachers. Manindra was one of these teachers. And what they found was there was this, starts with a C. Congruence, thank you. there was a congruence between how he lived and what he taught. So they thought, wow, here's somebody I can trust because of that. And that's one of the chapters. It's called Satcha, which means truthfulness or integrity. And it's not just truthfulness in the sense of not telling lies, but truthfulness in how you conduct your life and in just your very being, that kind of integrity. There are chapters on loving kindness. There's a chapter on loving kindness, on compassion, on generosity, on mindfulness, on patience, equanimity, wisdom, determination, energy, and so on. I narrowed it down to 16 qualities, even though there are more, but I distilled what is a bigger schemata into the 16 that I thought would be most relevant. And I would like to say also, these qualities are not exclusive to Buddhism. I was listening to an audiobook recently called The Lakota Way by John Marshall III. Some of you might be familiar with it. I was listening to his stories about his people and the qualities that they admired in their leaders and in the members of their group. And many of those qualities were similar. The names might be a little bit different, and an understanding of how they operated might be a little bit different. So the qualities that Manindra embodied and the way I write about them are in the context that he understood of being a Buddhist. But the message behind it all pertains to anybody, no matter which tradition you follow. In fact, some of his students, many of his students were from a lot of different traditions. One person I interviewed is a Christian spiritual counselor, and she said she learned so much from watching him deal with people, the patience that he had, even though they asked him all kinds of questions. And just, they always laughed with them. He always had a way of smiling, no matter how the people in the group were. So it doesn't matter what tradition you follow, you don't have to be a Buddhist to appreciate these qualities. And I'm going to tell you a story from some of the chapters. And I think I'll start with mindfulness, which is the first chapter, because it's really the key to everything else. Manindra emphasized this to his students. Everything is meditation in this practice. Even while eating, drinking, dressing, seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, touching, thinking. Whatever you are doing, everything should be done mindfully, dynamically, with totality, completeness, thoroughness. Then it becomes meditation, meaningful, purposeful. It is not thinking, but experiencing from moment to moment, living from moment to moment, without clinging, without condemning, without judging, without evaluating, without comparing, without selecting, without criticizing. Choiceless awareness. Meditation is not only sitting, it is a way of living. It should be integrated with our whole life. It is actually an education in how to see, how to hear, how to smell, how to eat, how to drink, how to walk, with full awareness. To develop mindfulness is the most important factor in the process of awakening. His emphasis on mindfulness really made him a great example of someone who never separated spiritual practice from daily life. It wasn't that right now I'm going to sit on this beautiful cushion, close my eyes, and meditate. And then when I get up from the cushion, I'm going to go into my daily life and do all of that. For him, there was no difference between the two. And people learned as much from him walking through the bazaar in India, or sitting in a chai shop having tea, or walking through a village as sitting in a meditation hall. Because it was seamless. There was nothing different about sitting and having a meal or talking to someone. Everybody knows about the Dalai Lama and his great gift of being totally present with the person who's right in front of them. It's that quality. Whatever is right there in front of you in the moment, that's what's happening. Not everything else. And that's the spiritual practice. It's not something that you set aside when you go to church or you go to synagogue or the hour that you do your prayers or your meditation. And this has been a really, really important lesson, I think, for the Westerners in particular who went to Asia and wound up meeting these teachers, was to see that it wasn't what they were experiencing in their communities. So, you know, you went on the weekend or you went on the holidays and that was it. So a friend of mine, which is how I got to know Manindra, her name is Kamala Masters, and she was very instrumental in helping me with this book, and also Robert Pryor, with whom I collaborated on this book. They both knew him for a very long time. Robert knew him since 1972. And Kamala knew him since 1977. I met him when I lived on Maui. She was my best friend, and he used to come and stay at her house. That was another thing. If he had been a monk, he never could have stayed at her house. No way. Even though she had a husband and three kids, there was just absolutely no way. A monk is not allowed to be under the roof with another woman in that way. So this enabled him, again, to just be among everybody. And she did not have time to practice in the way we think of practice. Going on retreats, going to a monastery. She was working full time and raising four children. How she ever had time to be my best friend, I still don't know. So I'm going to read you this passage and it'll give you an idea of what I mean about seamless integration. So she was struggling to raise her children, and Manindra did not let her family circumstances be an obstacle. When he found out that she spent a lot of time washing dishes, he immediately seized the opportunity to teach her sati, which is the Pali word for mindfulness, to teach her sati at the kitchen sink. He instructed her to have a general awareness of washing the dishes, the movement of her hands, the warmth or coolness of the water, picking a dish up, soaping it, rinsing, putting it down, every part of the process. Nothing else is happening now, just washing the dishes, he said. Then he told her to experience her posture. He did not insist on her moving slowly or observing every detail of her movement. Instead, she was to exercise general mindfulness of whatever was occurring as she cleaned the dishes. Standing next to her at the sink, Manindra would occasionally inquire, "What's happening now?" When she replied, "I'm worried about paying the mortgage," he would suggest, "Just notice worried and bring your attention back to washing the dishes." When she told him, "I'm planning what to cook for dinner," he repeated, "Just notice planning and go back to washing the dishes." Because that is what is in the present moment. Just notice what's in the present moment, go back to what you're doing. So Manindra guided Kamala with as much seriousness as though on a formal retreat. By practicing diligently, she soon realized its advantages. She said, "Doing this ordinary task with intentional mindfulness has helped me to notice and experience many things more clearly. The changing physical sensations, the flow of thoughts and emotions, and my surrounding environment are all much more alive. This practice helped collect my mind so that it was not so scattered. It has required me to develop more perseverance, patience, humility, clear intention, and honesty with myself. These are no small things, just from washing the dishes. The resulting enjoyment of being more fully present with life is a rare treasure in this world." And then you also noticed that she had to move around the house a lot, doing the laundry, picking things up after the kids, and so on. So he decided that it could be a good opportunity for her to use the small space, which is the hallway from the bedroom into the living area, and to use that as a kind of walking meditation. So he was standing on the threshold of her bedroom door and he said, "Okay, every time you step into this hallway, see if you can use this time as an opportunity to be present with the simple fact of walking. Just walking. Not thinking about your mother or about the children. Just experiencing the body walking. It might help you to make a silent mental notation of every step. With each step, very quietly in your own mind, you can note stepping, stepping, stepping. This will help you keep your attention connected to your intention of just walking. If the mind wanders to something else, as soon as you notice that it has wandered, make the silent mental note, wandering mind. Do this without judging, condemning, or criticizing. In a simple and easy way, bring your attention back to just the walking. Your practice in this hallway will be a wonderful training for you. It will also benefit those around you because you will feel more refreshed." The reason he said that, Manindra had enormous energy. Although he was decades older than his students, he could outwalk, outvisit, out everything, all of them. Joseph Goldstein and Sharon Salzberg, two of his early students, when he was visiting the United States, they took him to the Air and Space Museum in Washington, D.C. Manindra wanted to look at every single exhibit. Hours went by as he went from one exhibit to another, very carefully, mindfully, looking at everything, being present with everything he saw. Sharon, when she woke up from her bench, looked over, and Joseph was lying on another bench. The two of them, as I said, decades younger than he was, had to take a nap. He had these incredible reserves of energy. Now, it's also possible he was born with that kind of system. He was wiry. But the thing about mindfulness is that he never wasted energy going over the past or imagining into the future. He stayed in the present. And so he was never draining himself, worrying about what was to come or going over what had already happened. If he was eating, he ate. When he finished eating, he went on and did something else. When he was looking at an exhibit in the museum, he looked at that, then he went on to the next thing. Everybody else was tired except for him. And he even had students in Bodh Gaya. Robert Pryor, the person I collaborated with on this book, is director of the Antioch Education Abroad Program in Buddhist Studies. So we're talking about college-age kids. in India for the first time. And he would show them around the area. He could outwalk all of them. He was amazing. And he was teaching until maybe a year before he died, which is in 2003, and he was born in 1915. Mm-hmm. Imagine. Even though he was so skillful in mindfulness and in all these other qualities, he was not an impractical person. A lot of times we think being spiritual means almost la-la, you know, just let it all. He was very practical, and he was extremely generous. You could not come into his presence without his offering you food, water, some kind of drink, juice. He always asked about your health. If there was anything wrong, he immediately went and took you to some homeopathic or naturopathic doctor and got you help. I mean, people went to India and they used to come down with all kinds of things, and he would drop everything he was doing and take them to get healed. And so he was extremely generous. If you gave him something, he immediately turned around and said, "Thank you. Now I can give to others." He never asked for anything for his services as a teacher, nothing. In fact, there's a story I want to read. Let's find the page. Well, I don't remember what page it's on, but what happened was all these Westerners were there, and Meninja was taking care of them. He was finding them places to sleep, he was feeding them, he was teaching them. And people were thinking, wow, this is great, right? Can you do anything in America without paying? So, but one student said, Joseph Goldstein, said, you know, wait a minute, here we all are. We come from backgrounds that have we have so much more in the way of resources than this little Indian man. What's the story here? Why is he taking care of us? He's doing all these things for us. So Joseph went up to him and said, you know, Meninja, you're doing all this. Should we be paying you? And he said, if you want to, if you like, if you feel you're deriving some benefit, but no need. He never asked for anything. And when Joseph realized what was going on, he decided to share his income with him, because he had been freely giving all his services. And it was a lesson for many of the students in unprompted generosity. He never asked for anything. In fact, he said, I have no right to ask for anything. I am a lay person. Only monks go out and ask for alms. So he was basically living off the goodwill of people. Sometimes he had, sometimes he didn't. He so trusted the Dharma. He took such good care of the Dharma, and he trusted that the Dharma would take care of him. And so gradually people did. They would buy him a railway ticket, or get him food, or give him money, or get him books, and things like that. But when he came to America, he went shopping practically nonstop. And at first, you know, it seemed like, this is a spiritual teacher. My friend Kamala would take him with her on her errands. This is on Maui. And he'd be resting in the car. You know, he had his eyes closed. And suddenly she'd pull up into a long. In those days on Maui, we had no big box stores. We had one store, long. Everything you wanted, you had to find at Long's drugstore. So she pulled up to Long's, and she said, oh, I'm just going to go into Long's for a minute. You can keep resting. And he said, shopping? We're going shopping? And he suddenly stood up in his seat and get ready to get out of the car and go in there. And I remember when she told me this, I kept thinking, this is a spiritual teacher? He wants to go shopping? So then she tells the story. So they're in Saigon, and they're in the, I guess there's an area where there, I remember now, there were umbrellas. And so she said, you know, do you want an umbrella? And he said, I want all the umbrellas. Like, what? You want all the umbrellas in this store? And he said, you know, where I come from, there are so many children who have nothing, and I want to bring back things for the children. And so whenever he went shopping, it was never for himself. Everything he got was to bring back to people who had very little. And I want to tell this story about the flea market. I've got to find the page, though. Because, again, it was one of those instances where his behavior seemed a little strange, but you'll see. Manindra especially delighted in going to flea markets to buy gifts. Ginny Morgan describes an experience that she, Greg Galbraith and John Van Keppel had at a small flea market in Massachusetts. We went up to one booth where Manindra saw a little piano keyboard for children. The gentleman behind the table looked like he had had a difficult night and wasn't with it that morning. He appeared tired and kept rubbing his eyes. Manindra held this toy up and said, "How much for this?" The man looked at him and said, $10. Manindra responded, "Would you take $5? And the guy said, "Are you crazy? Give it up. I'm not going to do it." Manindra put it down and said, "Please, I want to take it to the children in India." This man said, "Ah, geez," and hit himself in the forehead with his hand, walked back and forth behind his counter, then finally got down on his hands and knees and dug around in a box. Manindra was very patient. The guy pulled out 2 batteries and plunked them down on top of the keyboard and handed it over to Manindra. He said, "I don't know why I'm doing this. $5 and I'll throw in the batteries." Then he turned to me and said, "Lady, I bet you bring him to do all your shopping." Manindra folded his hands in the prayer position and looked at this man full on and said, "May you be happy and peaceful. May you live with ease and well-being. And may you come to know full freedom from suffering." Jimmy says, "I watched a red flush spread up this guy's neck and into his face. He seemed really shocked. He turned to me and said, 'Lady, we need this stuff.' And I said, 'Yes, we all need this stuff.' Then a woman in the next booth came running up and said, 'Oh, for crying out loud, it's Gandhi, because he was right." Wore white robes, and as you can see, he wore the kind of glasses that Gandhi wore. Never mind that Gandhi was dead by I don't know how many years. So he'd go to these flea markets, and he'd cram full suitcase. Just, he'd get to the airport. This was the airport in Boston one time, and his stuff was so overweight, I mean, like by hundreds of dollars. And he was trying to do, you know, the starving children in India number. And the airline agents, they didn't care. And the guy who was taking him to the airport didn't have any money to pay for the overage. And just then, one of his old students came running into the airport to say goodbye to him, whipped out her credit card and said, "Here, just take this stuff." He had great intentions to bring all this stuff back to people. Unfortunately, customs in India would take whatever they wanted first. So, you know, but the thing in Dharma practice is, it's not about the results, It's about your wholesome intention. Because we don't have control over the results. All we have control over is what our motivation is. Is it wholesome or unwholesome? And his motivation was born out of a very deep sea of generosity and compassion for others. How am I doing time-wise? I didn't even know. Oh, I should stop.
It's kind of up to you guys. If you've got time for one more story, that's great.
Well, what kind of story? Because I have all kinds of stories.
A million hours. Mm-hmm. I don't know. I'm really enraptured.
Yeah.
I'm sure some people.
Let's see. What other? Let's see. Well, do you want a funny story or do you want a poignant story? A funny story. Okay. So, what happened? By the way, I could not have written the book without my husband's support. For those of you who don't know Larry, he made it possible. He made it possible for me to be up here full time working on the book and having the delicious quiet and freshness of this environment. It would have been really hard otherwise. I mean, living up here is just the best. I'm thinking about another book. what chapter is that in? I'm not sure whether I wrote that down or not. Okay. Oh, yes, I know which chapter that's in. Okay. All right, so I'm going to go on. Meninger was known for his never-ending curiosity. And one of the chapters is about the quality of investigation, of questioning, of testing, of looking into, not just accepting what somebody tells you or something that you read in scripture, but testing it out for yourself, inquiring, deep inquiry. And this was the curiosity for him was not just investigating the Dharma, but anything and everything wherever he went, like the museum story I told you about. So I'm not sure whether this was the same trip in Washington, D.C., or he had gone several times, but Stephen Schwartz told me this story, and it took place in the late 70s. They were staying at an apartment of a friend of his. Meninger asked how they were going to travel back to Barre, Massachusetts. And Stephen replied, "We're going to take the train." "When are we going?" "Thursday in the morning." "What time are we going?" 9:00. The questions did not cease, especially because, accustomed to the overcrowded train system in India, Meninger was skeptical and kept reiterating the same queries. Finally, I said, "Meninger, you have asked this question about 9 times. You obviously know the answer. What's up?" He said, "I want to make sure that we can get on the train." "We'll get on the train, don't worry." "Well, do you have tickets?" "No, you get tickets there." "You can't get tickets there. The tickets may be sold out." Anyone who's been to India will understand. "Well, they don't sell out because it's an open train." "That's not possible. The train could get sold out. How many seats are there?" "I don't know how many seats there are." "Can't there be more people than there are seats here?" "Well, yes." "What do they do?" "They stand." "Can't there be more people than there's room to stand?" "Well, yes." "Then why are you taking the chance? Why don't you get a reservation?" So Stephen called Amtrak to make a reservation. He was on the phone for 2 hours before he finally got through and made a reservation. I told Manindra, the reservation is set. Are you happy now? Where are the tickets? I don't have the tickets. How can you have a reservation without having the tickets? Because we did this on the telephone. How can you make a reservation on the telephone? That's the way it works in the United States. Stephen continues. He doesn't believe me and says, you don't have the reservation, do you? You just didn't want to get the reservation, so you told me you stayed on the phone. Like anyone would have come to us on the phone. Manindra, I wouldn't do that. I have the reservation. Here's my reservation number. Stephen continues. He says, I don't think this is going to work. I said, it's going to work, believe me. We now have a reservation on a train that you don't really need a reservation for. He says, the flip side of Manindra's curiosity was his doubting mind. Not doubting about the truth, but doubting about whether things will really work in a particular way. It's that doubting that gives rise to curiosity. Stephen says that when they got to the Amtrak station, he went to a ticket machine, put in his credit card, and out came the ticket. Manindra looks at the machine, then looks at me, and asks, where's the man? What man? The man who gives the tickets. There's no man that gives the tickets. They're in the machine. Well, where's the man who takes the money? There's no man who takes the money. It's invisible. Invisible money? Stephen continued. He sat me down and said, you're going to explain this to me because I don't understand how it works. So I explained to him that I was putting a piece of plastic into a machine and a message was being sent from this machine to Washington, D.C., to Tulsa, Oklahoma, which was the center for American Express. The message said, Bill Schwartz's card, $95 for two tickets. Once that message was sent, another message was sent to Newark, New Jersey, which was the center of the Amtrak system, to release two tickets. And once that message was sent back to Washington, D.C., to this machine, two tickets came out. He was so amazed and kept saying, how can people in Tulsa know what people in Washington and Newark are doing instantaneously? Then suddenly, he made the connection. That's exactly how the mind works. All of this happens instantaneously, but we don't see it. Memory, conditioning, karma, or things that happen over time and space. It is all invisible, but the Dharma makes that visible. So, I wanted to tell you stories about how this man emanated loving kindness, but there's not enough time. So what I'd like to do, he never ended a talk or a letter. He didn't do email, he didn't type or anything. But he wrote by hand and he never ended a letter or a talk without extending loving kindness to the people there. So if you feel like joining me, let's just take a minute to do some loving kindness. Would that be okay? Mm-hmm. Okay. So again, be comfortable. And then we can have questions and answers afterwards. So be comfortable. Close your eyes if you like. And focus your attention on your heart center. Just feel yourself breathing in at the heart center. And I'm going to repeat some phrases. I'm going to say some phrases that you're welcome to repeat internally, silently. Or if you feel like changing the wording, you can do that too. May I be free from inner and outer enemies. May I be free from mental and physical suffering. May I be able to find peace and happiness in this life. May I be safe and protected from danger and harm. May I be happy and peaceful of heart and mind. May I be strong and healthy of body. May I live with greater ease of well-being. May I be happy just as I am. May I be peaceful with whatever is happening. And there is no freedom from suffering. And now let's extend that loving kindness. May all beings in this room, in this community, in this environment, all beings on the land, all beings in the sea, all beings in the air, may all beings be happy. May all beings be peaceful. May all beings be free from suffering. And whenever you feel ready, remnant of Buddhists in India, the Barua clan, Bengali Buddhists. And he grew up with two brothers, mother and father. His father was educated, his mother was not. His father taught them ethics and learning in general. And his mother took care of everyone with so much love. And I think that's where it started for him, because he just seemed to be a naturally happy, cheerful, joyful, loving person. He loved everyone, and he felt everyone loved him. He had no idea that anyone might not like him. And I thought, wow. First time I realized that, to grow up feeling that you just see the good in everyone, you just love everyone, and you feel that everyone feels that way toward you, instead of being paranoid about how people feel about you. Mm-hmm. And also, he grew up in East Bengal, which later became Bangladesh. But during his time, the villages were Buddhist, Muslim, Hindu, and there was no friction. And so he never felt discrimination towards anybody. The first time he was in a railway station it was either Calcutta or Sarnath, and he heard people calling Hindu Pani, Muslim Pani, Pani is water, that there was one kind of water for Hindus to take, kind of like what we said in the South, you know, for blacks, and then there was another kind of water for Muslims. He had never heard of such a thing. He had never grown up in that kind of environment. And he just thought it was awful. He never treated people like that. Yes?
The last story you told, demonstrating his curiosity, also implies worry, which seems incongruous. It sounds like he was worried about the fact that he would not be able to be on that train, and yet if he's living in the present, that just, it seemed just a little incongruous.
Mm-hmm. Yes, and that's why I tell these stories in the book, because he never told anybody he was perfect. He was a fallible human being. And while it looks like worry to us, if you have ever been in India, you would realize that what he was actually expressing was practical concern. I remember letting vehicles go by, could be a bus, could be a train, because I wasn't going to push with everybody else. And I'd be there, and then the next one would go by, and I was never getting on until finally I realized, I'm never going to get out of here if I don't do what they do. So he was coming from a place of living with, I don't even know what the population of India was then, but you know, it's off the charts. And so, yes, you could go to a train, and you wouldn't even have any place to stand. I was on those trains. It was impossible to even stand. You'd just be crunched between other people. So that's why I tell those stories, because there is the practical concern, and yes, he was attending to what was there in the moment. We're going to take this train. We have to deal with it. We have to prepare for it. Once that's all taken care of, he moves on. Yes.
Wherever he visited and traveled, did people that he was, he had hosts and hostesses.
Yes.
So they would take care of his needs.
Yes.
So that he would eat, but he wouldn't cook.
Yes.
And he would plan in some, so this woman that was multitasking, we would say.
Yeah.
When she was doing the dishes, she was also planning dinner.
Right.
He didn't, I almost don't see how he would do any planning in this situation if you're supposed to be so focused in the moment that you can't, you know, devote yourself to, unless you meditate. And when you meditate, like when I do, I concentrate on breathing,
mm-hmm.
except when I'm failing my meditation, which is continuous.
He would never let you use that word.
Failing?
Never. See, that's judgment.
Yeah.
Well, but never
you're judging and criticizing.
How did he do in these other activities?
I'm really glad you brought that up, because someone asked him that question. He said, you know, Manindra, I'm going to go back to the United States, and I want to go to school, and I need to plan, and I need to fill out forms, and I, you know, all this kind of stuff, if I'm always just in this moment. He said, in this moment, you plan all these things that you need to do. You take care of all of that. You plan your trip. You plan your whatever it is. You take care of that, and then you go on to the next thing. What he was talking about was that we carry that with us. We're driving, and we're thinking about this, and then we're thinking about that, and we're doing. We don't let it go, even though we sat down and we wrote everything down on a piece of paper. Then we're going over it again, and we're thinking of more things. Do you see what I mean?
Yeah, sure.
So he did. He had to plan certain things.
A planning moment.
But you have, in this moment, you're planning. In this moment, you're eating. In this moment, you're walking. In this moment,
mm-hmm.
you're watching your breath. It's not that, it's just whatever is in that moment, that's what you're with. Now, whether he ever thought, at 6 o'clock every day I'm going to do such and such, I don't know. But he just did what he had to do in the moment. Yes, Fred.
Yeah, forgive me if any of this came up when I wasn't here in your discussion or your comments. Did you ever have any talks with him about war or poverty or the Holocaust or things of that nature?
I personally didn't, and I don't know whether other people did. Nobody brought it up in the conversations I had, and I interviewed about 200 people around the world, because he had such an impact, and people from all over got to know him.
So you didn't know what he would say on the subject of man's inclination to be in conflict in these extreme ways throughout history?
I don't know. I wish I could tell you. I wish I could ask him. You know what? I'll have to reflect on that, because I, when I was working on the book, and even now, I just, when things come up for me in my own life, I really do think, how would Manindra deal with it? That's, working on this book has brought him so close to me in a way that I was not close with him when he was alive, that now I think, okay, and situations have come up, and I just think, what would he do? And it really has changed how I'm dealing with him.
And I'm going to air that interview we did again tomorrow morning.
Oh, are you? Okay.
100.5.
What time?
10 o'clock, I'm sorry.
10 o'clock on 100.5 FM.
You are so kind to come. I, familiar faces and faces I don't know. I really appreciate your generosity in taking the time to come this afternoon.
Thank you so much.
And if you have some more questions, I'm happy to come. If anybody wants me to sign a book, just let me know.
And we have books right here. If you haven't bought one yet, you can have... you can have it signed here and then take it on down to the bookstore. We trust you. And just let's just say thanks one more time. That was so good.
Okay.
And thanks to Mary. And thanks to all of you. And
thank
enjoy
you.
The afternoon and evening.
Thank you.
I'm not used to all these data.